Take two, site two, talking about Earl Sugden and trilobites.
Just a reflection on how Earl impressed my thinking as a little boy. I'm sure one of the first things that he brought me was a book on the evolution of the horse. And I was so amazed to believe that that great big Percheron could have evolved from this little fox-like animal. And there it was, stage by stage by stage, the five-toed Eohippus, and eventually the having been driven from the forest, driven onto the prairies, and only those survived that could run, and five toes were an impediment as a fast runner, and so eventually they lost two toes on each foot, and only those survived that could run fastest, and the ones that survived were the ones that had less toes, and eventually they lost those toes and had the big middle toe became enlarged, which gave the horse the hoof that caused him to be able to outrun all the predators, and he was able to survive not as the little five-toed Eohippus, but as a one-hoofed fast animal. I was so intrigued to learn this, and I was also intrigued to look at the layers of rock on the west side of the valley and to realize that there was a time when those layers of rock reached clear across to the east side of the valley, and that all the intervening layers had been washed away, and that the bottom valley was far below where the level of the dirt is now. That sometimes another thing that Earl taught me and showed me is where there had been old waterfalls way up on the hillsides. There are the flints that had washed down old primitive primordial canyons. The flints that had washed and been rolled over and over and over at the bottom of waterfalls until you could almost trace the course of the old river by the riverbed being way over on this hillside, finding the same riverbed over on this other hillside, and a rapids over here and a rapids over there, and thinking that here was where the old original valley was clear way up there, 300 or 400 feet above where the river is now. And it meant so much to me to be able to visualize that in my mind. One of the things that Earl liked to do was do sleight of hand tricks. And he was always perfecting all of Houdini type sleight of hand tricks that he could, just simply to intrigue kids and children.
Yeah, very respectful of where the limits came in mystery, wasn't he? I remember that he was very hesitant to discuss psychics and hypnosis because he had dabbled in that at one time and he had some bad experiences. And that he drew a line. He'd studied it and he'd read about it.
He had sort of gone from the extreme of being the atheist to getting involved in mysticism. And I'm not familiar enough with his experiences there to comment on them very much, but he did have the feeling of interpersonal communication with nonverbal and psychic.
And almost an awareness that this was a realm, a Pandora's box he wasn't going to be opening.
I think so.
Which for him was quite a decision.
Yeah.
Since his curiosity drove him to a lot of other boxes that most people wouldn't consider opening.
What other events in his life do you remember? I'd like to hear more about him coming to the store. Are there any other days?
Just the perpetual occurrence of coming every day and hardly leaving long enough to go home and get his dinner sometimes. He didn't come really so much in the forenoons. It would be afternoon and evening that he would come. He was really making himself a nuisance to people, though. because he always went to call on people with big families of kids and try to tell the kids stories, and he liked to tell ghost stories. He was a storyteller. Mark, you would have loved Earl Sunken. He would have been a character that you would have spent hours and hours with, because he had that memory, and he liked to tell ghost stories just simply to make the kids conscious of their fears. Yeah.
Do you remember any of the ghosts?
No, I don't remember the story.
Were they stories that he had made up or stories that he had heard?
I think they were stories. He carried a lot of memories from his mother, and the Sugdens had lived in Massachusetts and had migrated down in the area of Milwaukee, and then had come into this area there, and he brought a lot of those memories from his mother, that she had, the songs that he sang were the lullabies that his mother...
He was Welsh origin.
Yeah, I think the name Sugden is a Welsh name. One of the songs that he used to play on his flute was the Nell, K-N-E-L-L, the Nell of Narragansett Bay. And it was the story of a girl named Nell who died somewhere along the shores of Narragansett Bay. And so apparently that's the area that they came from in New England. Well, Mark, what have you got?
Well, I'm going to ask Gynet and Katie what stories they're going to suggest you to tell. I mean, I could ask questions, but today they're here and I'm going to give them a first shot at you.
Hmm.
What stories do you want them to tell?
Well, I think the stories that are really important to tell and to have are the family stories, especially of how the Silas Carpenter came here and the land. Some of those you may have. How the family got the land, and I love the stories of how the men went off to the Civil War and left the women here, and that whole period. I think that's fascinating. That also, I think this.
Particular incidents that you want incidents.
Yeah.
But as you start with a theme, you get into incidents.
I didn't tell the story of Grandpa living with his first wife up in the valley, in what is known now as Snow Valley, before he went to the Civil War. And at night, they would see a face at the window by candlelight. And he would go to the door, and it would be an Indian. And the Indian would say, "Oh, me heap bad Indian." And Grandpa said he would go into the house and get him a half a loaf of bread and a glass of milk and take it out, because heap bad Indians were the kinds that he wanted for his friends. He didn't want them for his enemies. And then Grandpa somehow or other moved down to a log house back of where the store is, and walked to Lone Rock and left his wife pregnant with their first child, and went away to the Civil War, and was gone from about 13 months, I think, before he came back to the Civil War. And he was with General Sherman on the march to the sea, and he's told how the Negroes were so confused by liberty that one of the haunting things that he remembered was how the fellows in the army camp would get the Negro boys to come in and jig, and they would give them a penny or a slice of bread or just almost anything to get them to make spectacles of themselves and to jig and in the camp at night. And he said you could watch them, and then all at once the most terrible expression would come over their face, and they'd say, "Oh, I'm going back to Massa." And they would rush out of the camp back to a plantation that had already been destroyed. Grandpa felt so bad, because at one time he had to go into a plantation and burn a big library of books. And he felt, and he also felt that the misuse of Southern women by the Union soldiers was disgraceful. We don't allow ourselves to admit that this sort of thing is a part of our history, but it is. And Grandpa felt that it was a tragedy. He and his old friend Newton Chismore had gone together, and somehow or other, Grandpa got switched up on sentry duty and went off to sleep on sentry duty, and was hailed into a kangaroo court martial and was sentenced to be shot for going to sleep on sentry duty. And somehow or other, Newt managed to get him released. And I think the war was getting to the point of being pretty well over at that time, and they were not quite as severe in their application of military discipline as they had been before. But he always felt a high spot in his heart for Newt, because Newt had saved his life during the Civil War.
Why do you think he decided to go to the war? Was it a conscription? Was there some kind of sense of patriotism?
You were forced either to... There was conscription. And if you didn't want to go, it was a lottery. And it was a pretty broad one. Most of the guys were allotted to go, but there were certain people who were fortunate enough not to have to go. And if you could hire somebody who was not allotted to go in your place, you could be excused. Somebody had to go to fill that number. But of course, Grandpa had no finances, and I think probably he was conscripted. Now, whether this how great was his patriotism, I don't really know. There's somebody going to do that. But in Richland County, there was a time when there was a certain amount of not conflict, but abrasion between the few Indians that were left and the whites that were constantly coming into the area. And so there was a time when they were both Indians and whites here. And Mr. Hyde was a close pioneer here at Rockbridge, living on what now has been called the Cunningham Farm for so many years. But like most farms, it was back in the valley where there was a big spring. And Mr. Hyde went out hunting, and he took with him his 44 caliber muzzle-loading rifle. There's a high cliff along, which is over the river, and Mr. Hyde was walking along the edge of this cliff looking out over the swamps and the bottoms that are west of the river when he spotted a deer, and he just simply very quickly loaded his muzzle-loading rifle and picked it up quick and made a quick shot, and the deer fell. Well, at the time the deer fell, there was another shot also, and out of the woods came an Indian, and the Indian claimed the deer, and Mr. Hyde was up on the cliff, and he called and he said, "No, I shot the deer," and the Indian said, "No, he shot the deer." And right away there were quite a lot of anger between them, and Mr. Hyde very quickly reloaded his rifle, and the Indian reloaded his rifle, and the Indian was swinging his rifle around to take a shot at Mr. Hyde, when Mr. Hyde raised his rifle quick and shot at the Indian. The Indian fell right across the deer. Well, even in primitive Richland County, you don't go out and shoot an Indian without having to give some accounting to the authorities. And so they decided they better hold a coroner's inquest to see whether Mr. Hyde might be guilty of murder or negligence or second-degree murder or self-defense, or what kind of grounds that he should be allowed to shoot this Indian, or if he really should be convicted of murder and sent to jail. And so at the coroner's inquest, the attorney that was representing Mr. Hyde said, well, now, the thing that has happened here is that, well, Mr. Hyde has a 44 caliber rifle, which is about that big around, about as big as between the size of a nickel and a quarter. But he also has a 32 caliber, which is considerably smaller than a dime. And what really happened in this case of shooting this Indian was that, I missed a point, didn't I, Mark? He was saying that the defender was saying that when he examined the body, he was shot not with a 44 caliber rifle, but with a smaller bullet hole. And he said, how could this happen? Mr. Hyde must not have done it. And then they finally concluded that Mr. Hyde had reached in his pocket for a 44 caliber ball to drop down into the 44 caliber barrel. But instead of that, he got the 32 caliber ball and dropped it down, which would just rattle around in that big rifle barrel. And the attorney said, well, could he shoot accurately with his rifle, with his ball rattling around in that big barrel that way? And he said, no, I guess we'll have to say that this Indian died by accident. Is kind of that the way you remember it, Meyer?
I have some notes from the last time. She said I should ask you about a dog fight at a school.
Oh, we were talking about play day. Remember last time we were talking about the play day? School picnics and play day. This was the school picnic. Well, I have to sort it out in my mind a little bit, but Mrs. Anderson, who was a very sensitive lady in Rockbridge, had a beautiful big collie dog. And she came to the picnic, and her dog followed her. And the children at the cheese factory had a little mongrel dog, which also followed them to the picnic. And, of course, in the course of all events, why, there became a dog fight. The big collie dog grabbed the little dog, and Mrs. Anderson didn't want her dog to pick on the little dog, so she grabbed her dog by the tail, and they went round and round and round and round trying to pull her dog off from the little dog. Well, Mrs. Klingemann, a bystander, decided that she would get into the dog fight too. So she grabbed a stick of wood out of the wood pile. She took a big swing at the little dog. She took a big swing at the big dog, missed the big dog, and hit the little dog. Just knocked him colder than a coconut. And there the little dog lay on the ground. And here were all the children from the Bladels kids from the cheese factory. Oh, our dog is dead, our dog is dead. Mrs. Anderson ran off home, taking her dog with her, crying because her dog, she was being blamed because they had killed the other dog. The kids at the cheese factory carried their dog home in their arms, crying that somebody has killed our dog. Well, when they got him down at the cheese factory, they dipped him in a tank of water and he came too. Yeah, and school picnic.
Another note I have here is to ask you about discipline at a country school, and there's supposedly a specific story.
Discipline was the ultimate answer of being a country school teacher. Even though you might be a good teacher, if you couldn't maintain discipline with the age spread that you had between kids 6 and kids 16, you simply had to be able to maintain discipline, or law and order were out the window, and you were just not able to accomplish anything. And this meant, in a way, of the teacher always carrying a threat, not allowing the kids to know what you would do if you really blew your stack and went hog wild as far as discipline was concerned. If you really laid it on out and really followed through, if they knew what their limit was, you lost the ball game right at that point, because they would drive you to that limit and then you didn't have anything to go any farther. So you had to go around with carrying that threat, which is the threat that the atomic world is based on today, in which each side doesn't know the limit the other one will go. And this is you were in a state of perpetual threat all the time as far as discipline is concerned. You could be as good as you wanted to the kids, and they would be good in return, but you always had to carry that ultimate threat. But boy, if you don't behave, I'll lay you low. And so I had this school up here at Rockbridge and about 40 kids in it, and I had six big boys. And these boys were not quite as old as I was, but some of them were bigger than I was. And they were a constant threat to me, and I was wondering all the time what would happen if someday they really took up my challenge and I had to show what I would do. Well, it came about one day. And one of the boys, I said, Warren, if you don't quit whispering back there and get down and do your work, I'm going to come back there and lay you low. Well, in a little while, he was back doing the same thing again. And I said, Warren, I warned you about three times. Boy, you got to settle down. I'll just lay off of this whispering business and get your work. Let everybody else do their work. In a little while, he was doing the same thing again. So I thought, well, I guess this is it. And I went back and I just jumped over the recitation seat, kicked it over, went back and made all the noise and confusion all the way back. And I picked this kid up by the collar and the seat of his pants, and I took him out into the entryway, and I took him across my knee, and I just made the dust fly. And I'm sure that it sounded good and loud all over school. And I took him by the collar and I took him back in and I slammed him down in the seat and I said, now you go to work. Critical point. He looked around at the rest of the boys and he says, ho, 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 and expecting the rest of the boys to come to his support. And this was really critical for me. And I don't suppose I spent much time contemplating it, but I realized that this is the point at which I'm either in trouble or out of trouble. Those other guys were so scared, they stuck their noses down in their books, and they didn't even look at me. They all just looked right down, and everybody was working. And he said once more, ho, ho. Nothing happened. Dead silence. And then the poor kid started to cry. And he cried, and he cried, and he cried. And I felt so bad that I had probably used him that way, but I had surmounted the problem. I had discipline. From that point on, they knew that if something happened, I could go to the extreme. And so I was able to, and it carried along probably all that year, and for the years that I taught school, I had no discipline problem.
Probably even more than that, you knew you could. And sometimes when you're disciplining, you're never quite sure
Whether you can do it or not. I guess probably that's true.
Knowing you won't back down gives you more courage than anything.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on to the best stories. I want to hear about your courtship days.
Oh,
tell the story about when Mother's purse flew out of the car.
Very sharp story.
It's a good one.
Do you remember?
Yeah. Is that when we went around the corner and ran into the ditch?
Yep.
Oh. Well, of course, as far as the Gaineth is concerned, she was my first and only love.
He
says. No, but Gaineth was going out once in a while with a fellow who worked for us in the store, and I was going with several other girls.
And going meant driving long distances, really, didn't it?
Yeah.
Double dated.
Yeah, and anyway, somehow or other, I remember coming by there on Sunday afternoon, and she was sitting out in the yard, looking like, kind of like she was looking. And oh, you don't know. Oh, you were looking, kind of. You were sizing up everybody that went by. You know it just as well as I do. Anyway.
That wasn't too many of them.
No, that really wasn't true. That wasn't true, but... And she was teaching school, and I took her cousin to her Christmas program.
Wasn't
Whitler. No, it was.
You came to my school program with Lyle, and Garnet was there, and Paul, who was having a birthday party that night. So Lyle and I were going to go, and you were with Lyle, so I said, well, Garnet, why doesn't Garnet go along? So she was also a cousin of Paul.
Well, anyway. Anyway, when I went up there the next by myself the next week.
Not quite.
Well, nearly.
We went to a party.
No, she didn't know that I was going to marry her, but I knew that I was going to marry her. When I went up there, I knew that. I knew that that's who I was going to marry.
No, my,
you weren't sure. Oh, I was sure. You didn't have a chance.
What did your parents say?
Oh, I can't remember. Then we went together for a while, and like you have disagreements when you've gone together a while, and. I thought she was kind of throwing me over. And so then I took Ava's Bridge to the Hillsboro Fair. And when I got back, she called me up and wanted to know where I'd been.
Well, you should remember it differently than I do.
You have telephone? I just didn't know you had
telephone. Oh, of course. Oh, of course we had telephone. Yeah.
Well, we didn't have telephones when I was 10 years old.
Yeah, that's right.
That was well before that.
Yeah. Oh, one of the stories I didn't tell a while ago, should tell you about the high waters. The high waters. In our experience, the high waters, the floods.
I had the flood of 51.
Yeah. Well, anyway, when we lived at the farm and I had to take the kids to school, and I brought Katie to school, and Carol wasn't old enough to go to school yet, but she rode along with me in the Jeep, and we brought Katie to school. And when by the time we got back, the water was clear up over the floorboards of the Jeep. And we were going through the water up by the bridge. And I said to Carol, you know, Carol, the water's getting pretty deep in this Jeep. I think we're probably going to have to leave the Jeep here and wade home. And Carol said, oh, dear. And I didn't bring my overshoes. Water would have been over her head, probably. Why about the courtship? It was just a very logical... logical.
Well, you can tell it your way. I remember.
You want to pick up a classical? You decided to leave teaching before you got married, or you were in the store?
Take two, side one. I'm Mark Weidler talking to Halsey Reinhardt and family. July 28th, 1985.
Giving a little more of an expansion of the story of Sam Guthrie and the question about the skeletons at who?
Dale Muller
had asked about. One of my hunting memories as a little boy was the skeleton of presumably an Indian that was unearthed just by Sam Guthrie's house, which may have given the background which led Dale to ask the question of the skeletons. But in digging out the roadway, they found where this skeleton had lay under the edge of the rock and presumably had just been covered over almost with their hands. He was so close to the surface. And my own thinking is that this is probably one of Black Hawk's warriors who was wounded and died there, and his compatriots had just scooped out the sand and covered him rather than leave evidence that they were losing this many people. And I often thought somebody must have shed some tears. Somebody must have been his friend and have felt very sorrowful when this man was buried. The bones were brought then down to Dr. Hines, who was the doctor in Rockbridge, and Dr. Hines had the bones for many, many years. And now what actually became of them, I have no way of knowing. It would be interesting to know the final resting place of this warrior.
That's the skeleton you told me.
That's the skeleton.
Now, Katie and Gaina, are there Indian stories other than the one about the deer hunting the deer?
Could we go ahead and finish Earl Sugden?
Because I was going to say.
Okay. Yeah, Earl was our prize loafer at the store. And as he, after he had been released from teaching, because he taught evolution in the schools, back at about the time of the Scopes trial, at the time when evolution was a very, very bad and irreligious word, and even in spite of the fact that Earl was not consciously teaching evolution, in his teachings of nature and botany and biology, enough evidence of evolution kept sneaking through until eventually they wouldn't hire Earl any longer as a school teacher because he was one of those terrible evolutionists. But Earl continued to study all his life. And I have learned one thing about study. It's no fun unless you can share your learnings with somebody. And so everybody who would even pause became a student as long as they could stand it. Because Earl would tell them of what he had been studying lately and what he had learned and try to engage people in some kind of conversation, some interest, and maybe get a little sidelight that somebody else knew. But mostly it were the things that Earl knew. And he talked and he talked and he talked. And he was our prize loafer out at the store, having no place to go, living with his sister, whom I'm sure was glad to see him leave the farm about 5 o'clock and not come back until about 9:30. He would leave and head for the store, and maybe down in the afternoon sometimes when there was nothing to do at home. He would try to find somebody to talk to about the things that he was studying. And I have, in my own study of geology, how interesting it is when I find somebody that's interested enough to converse with you. And this is what Earl was always doing. He was always studying. When he became an old man and I went to see him in the nursing home as 84 years old, he was studying the geography of the moon. It was the time of the first moonshots. And I respected him so much for not just retiring back into the nursing home.
Remember, you were also telling me he was studying Sanskrit.
Yes, one of the languages that he was studying was Sanskrit, and he translated poems from the French. I have whole sheets of paper fastened together, which are French poems translated by Earl Sugden. He put all the Paul Bunyan stories into poetry. And he was always a little self-conscious about that because he said people read them because they thought they were funny. And what Earl Sugden was attempting to do was to tell the longest story that he could possibly combine into the fewest words. And there are about 4 small volumes of his Paul Bunyan stories down at the public library. And if you read them with that thought in mind, you can see the hand of genius in them. But one of his statements in there that really just carry with me from day to day, and I see it manifest so often: Paul Bunyan was like me or you. Whatever he thought was true. And I see this so much in my contact with people, that people are making their assumptions and thinking their assumption necessarily is true. He was a little bit of a disadvantage to have a perpetual loafer like that.
He was tired.
tiresome. All right, maybe that's the best word. It's a little tiresome to have somebody continually loafing and continually. And one of the things that he liked was music. And he knew all the mathematical processes by which you place the holes in the wooden flute. And he made his own flute, and he brought his flute to the store, and he played his flute. He could play the organ at home. He had the old treadle-type organ. And then he decided to make his own violin. And there was a butternut fence post, which had served its purpose, holding the barnyard fence for a good many years, but it offered a good hunk of whittleable, that's a hard word, whittleable material out to wake his violin out of. So he cut it down, and he cut off the top, and he cut off the bottom, and he cut out the frame, and he cut out the stem of it, and he glued it all together, and he got his strings, and he made the little things by which you tighten the strings, and he got hold of some real horse hair, right, direct from the tail of the horse, and he made his own bow. And then he brought his violin to the store and showed his violin. If you're interested in seeing his violin, it's still on display down in the Brewer Library. And it's a beautiful violin, although it has the appearance, of course, of being homemade and handmade. But Earl was down in the store, and he was playing his violin. And Katie was a little girl about 6 months old. Katie was a little girl about 4 years old, and Carol was about 6 months old.
Do this all over again.
Boy, I get there. Earl was playing his violin in the store at the time when we lived in the apartment that it was adjacent and half a floor higher than the store, and the sound was from the store was very audible in the house. And Katie was about 4, and Carol was about 6 months. Gyneth was trying so hard to get Carol to go to sleep, but through the walls came the sounds of Earl's violin. And the songs that he played were characters in themselves. They were the songs that he had heard his mother hum to him when he was a little boy. And they were the songs that came from the Eastern Seaboard. Probably some of them are entirely lost, but these were the songs that Earl played, but he was playing them on his violin there. And finally, I'm sure that she must have heard this stated very clearly, but Katie came to the store door and said, "Earl, my mother wishes you would take that old squeak box home." Being easily offended, Earl dashed out the door, clutching his violin in one hand and his bow in the other, and it was some time before he forgave Gyneth for such a terrible remark, but I think he was a little reluctant to bring his violin back to the store.
You didn't miss it. How was he
as a violin player? Oh, like he was at everything else. He had studied the theory, but he hadn't mastered the techniques. And so he was more theory than technique in whatever he did. Even his farming was more theory than technique. A man with a great mind, but not the stick-to-itiveness that makes you able to concentrate on any particular facet of what you are learning, but just learning over the whole broad field and not concentrating on any particular thing. But Earl affected my thinking so much. The things that he taught me, everybody conceded that, or assumed, I should say, that because Earl was an evolutionist, that he just obviously had to be an atheist. Because if you don't believe God created the world, you just don't believe in God. That's all there is to it. But Earl had a high respect for a supreme intelligence, and he felt that even in looking at the processes of nature, the processes of evolution, that you could see the hand of a higher intelligence here. And whether he was perhaps a little reluctant to associate it with the same God that the fundamentalist preachers were preaching about at the camp meeting.
I think I lost that because you're twisting the word. Do that again. Maybe I should just do the hammock. Oops, and I get
pull the cord back. I'll just, I think that, yeah, it's definitely.
When you twisted that, sound stopped coming through.
Is that so?
That's funny. Is it still connected here?
Yeah, it's all right here. I'll just.
Yeah.
Place the cord holder.
I guess I was saying that everybody assumed that Earl was an atheist because he was an evolutionist, which was far from the truth, that he did believe in a superior being. Strangely, when I was growing up, I had Mr. Hatch, the beautiful old retired minister. I guess I've talked about him, haven't I, Mark? I've talked about Mr. Hatch, how Mr. Hatch was educating me in all the theology that he would be able to teach me. Earl was educating me on all the evolution that he would be able to teach me. And I was kind of caught between these two fellas. And yet, there really wasn't a conflict. Because as much of a Christian and as a fundamentalist as Mr. Hatch was, he was just amazed and astounded and intrigued by the process by which things develop. So he, in a sense, was a Christian with a very close bent toward being an evolutionist. Earl, on the other hand, was an evolutionist who was following all the processes of evolution, but seeing the hand of a greater intelligence in that. So really there wasn't as much conflict between the two as there might appear to be at first thinking. And they were really good friends, and I think they respected each other. Mr. Hatch was a little bit questioning of Earl's belief in God, but I'm sure from my knowledge of both of them that they were both teaching me, and I think they were both a little suspicious of what the other one was teaching me. But I appreciate the fact that I had both of those old and intelligent men to be my teachers. I got a cross-section of,
you know, you have really a Unitarian philosophy, much like Frank Lloyd Wright. We were thinking yesterday on his grave, it says worship of an idea is worship of God. And how are they in time frame? Because here you have Frank Lloyd Wright, who had the same kind of genius, but the difference is that he had aunts who doted on him and guided his education and taught him that he was unique and unusual and had a right to bend the rules because he was unusual. And you had Earl Sugden, who had the same kind of genius without the guidance. Are they in the time frame? And here they were born 30 miles apart. Frank Lloyd Wright traveled the world and influenced the world forever. Earl Sugden, because not having a family like that, was really afraid to leave his farmstead.
But he knew the world. He read the world and was as familiar with the world as Frank Lloyd Wright.
You could draw a lot of parallels between those two men.
They were certainly two geniuses, one undiscovered. Earl did have a chance at one time, was encouraged to try to go down to Madison and write matriculation tests and go into the university. And stubborn. He was a stubborn man. He saw the logic, and it was hard to contradict his logic once he had seen this. I know how one of the things that amused me one time, he came bustling into the store and he said, "You know, I just almost got run into the, I was coming down the road and I was just doing 25 miles an hour. And when I came to that intersection up there at County Trunk, here came a guy 60 miles an hour right around the corner and he shot right out in front of me. He just almost hit me." Earl Tatter was out there and he said, "You know, Earl, that if instead of driving 25 miles an hour, you'd been driving 35 miles an hour, like you ought to have been driving on the highway, you'd have been down here. You wouldn't have been up at that corner with that close action come." Well, this was so illogical that it just threw him. He just stomped around all evening thinking, how dumb a remark that was. If you could avoid coincidences in life by going faster or going slower. I think I have thought of that a lot of times when I'd start out on a trip and
and I'd be delayed 5 minutes, I'd think, I wonder if this is the 5 minutes that's going to bring me at the corner sometime when some guy was going through that corner. If I'd have been 5 minutes earlier, I wouldn't have hit him. I think I've picked up that particular bit of illogic.
But he
logic.
Just wouldn't travel, would he?
No. And another thing about Earl Sugden, he was always so self-conscious. He always wore a big, wide, bibbed overalls and a gray shirt, tied up, buttoned up tight at the collar, because he had a big goiter, and he was very, very self-conscious about that goiter. He wouldn't have gone to the university because he wouldn't have fit in his appearance. And it wasn't a time when you dared wear very far from the norm until you would have been characterized right away because of your appearance. But
he also said once he was thankful on Thanksgiving Day, he only had one tooth, because that's all he had was one tooth.
Yeah, he pulled his own teeth. As in older life, as they became bothersome, why, he just simply took a pair of pliers and pulled them.
I think the story that's most illuminating too, that we wrote or somewhere we put it down, that he was mildly interested once in a girl, and he was so proud that he was very easily hurt and driven away, and that by his family laughing at that.
Somehow or other, he had an experience of some girl coming on a little strong, and it frightened him so badly that he never was interested in the other sex in his whole life. He never had a girlfriend, I don't think. He told me a little of that one time, and I don't remember what the background of it was, but he was probably, when he was in the seventh or eighth grade somewhere, somebody came on him a little romantic, and it scared him away. But I was starting to say about his appearance that he was rather haphazard in his appearance all his life and very self-conscious of it. And when he died, I, as one of his best friends, I didn't go to his funeral, and I regret this. I'm not sure we had something that...
You were at my house, and I wish I could remember what we were doing, because we... In our own way, we remembered Earl Sugden that day.
But we missed going to his funeral.
And as unorthodox as he was, it didn't seem like going to his funeral was what we needed to do to observe what Earl would have wanted at a memorial. You know, somehow a funeral didn't seem appropriate for Earl Sugden.
But anyway, I went to the undertaking parlor the night before his funeral, and here he was in a suit with a white shirt and a nice tie, and his hair combed, and he was handsome. He had no reason to be self-conscious of his appearance through his life. He was tall, broad-shouldered, and erect, and if someone had encouraged him and made him feel that he was handsome, he could have been handsome. He was a beautiful man. And I said to the undertaker, I said, boy, he's a beautiful man. He's just handsome. He said, that's the best compliment that I ever had. I remember, and we have movies of this particular point, and I will have to review them sometime. We'll have to get all those old movies going again this winter. Anyway, we were going to lay our road, what we call the Burma Road, up over the hill from our farm buildings over to where Marilyn lives. Well, we called it the Burma Road because it was about the time that the Burma Road was being laid out across Burma in World War II. And it went up the hill, and it went over some little knolls and through the woods, into the woods, and up through the woods and followed down on the other side. And I hired a man with a bulldozer to come and make the road. But Earl, in his genius, had said, well, now I'll come up and I'll stake that road out for you, because I understand the hydraulic graphics of staking a road out so that it won't wash. And if I stake the road out and give it a certain grade, and we maintain that grade all the way, and the little low spots where it can empty itself off to the side, and won't have any distance to pick up a headwater of eroding current. We'll make that road up there over those little knolls and go out around. Don't make it any place where it's steep. Don't go over the knolls. So there's a little steep pitch, but have an even grade all the way. So Earl very carefully staked out the road. And here came the man with the bulldozer. He'd laid out roads all his life. He didn't look to the left or look to the right. He just took right up over the hill, and where there had been those little amixes and little hills that Earl had so carefully staked the road out to go around, he just leveled them as he went right straight through. And Earl just was so angry. I've never seen him so angry. Oh, that ignorant man with that bulldozer who wouldn't pay any attention to those stakes that I had put up there on the hillside at all. And he was really offended. One of the things, Earl is a farmer, had 40 acres, and he sort of bred his cattle for intelligence. And he always said that you could have a bunch of ignorant cattle that you couldn't commune with, you couldn't communicate with at all, or if you kept the right cattle from the right animals, that you would have cattle that were very docile in nature and easily handled and never kicked the pail out from your hands and all those things. That you had, not only did you have to breed your cattle for production, you had to breed them for their own mental capacity and emotional stability. So this was one of the things that he worked on all his life. One of the things that he was sure that he had, his calves, he said, even the newborn calves, you can point to the gate and the calf will go right through the gate. Now, whether he had worked that out or not, but he insisted that he had developed a strain of cattle that had a super intelligence over the other cattle that were up and down the valley. One of the things he hated was silos. He just hated silos with a vim. And he could statistically prove to you that during the Depression years, the fellows who had the most silos were the guys who went broke first. And he might be able to follow the same kind of mathematics today. The guys with the harvest stores may be the ones that are going under faster. But his concept was, and his contention was, that putting that feed into the silo destroyed its food value, created an acid feed that ate the cattle's teeth out and their stomachs, cut down the length of life of the cattle, and was just generally with poor management. And on his farm, he didn't even have a team of horses to do work with. He just had a hay field, and he cut his hay, had someone come in and cut his hay. No, he had a mower that he pulled behind his Model T Ford. And then he bought a little C. Alice Chalmers tractor, which is the littlest baby tractor that you could possibly imagine. And he had his mower, and he had his plow, and he did his total farming with that little C. Alice Chalmers tractor. But he had done a lot of it with his Model A Ford before. I talked about putting the wire on his choke wire, didn't I? You have.
I don't have that on a good tape.
On a good tape. Well, of course, Earl was always going down at Hub City and loafing there until he got a little angry at the boys in Hub City who played tricks on him. Then he came down and gave us the benefit of his loafing hours. His Model T Ford that he had before, he had the 28 Model A Coupe. And the Model T Ford, if you are familiar with them at all, have the crank out in front. And they also have a little choker wire with a little loop on the end of it that stuck out the side of the radiator. And the way that you started one, of course, was you switched it on and you went out and you pulled on the choker and you spun the crank. And you choked it, and then you let the choker back in. Because if you choked it too much when it started, then it would choke itself to death and stop. So the boys put a fish line on his choker wire. I guess you have to continue the story to say also that there was a point in time at about 1920 when the Model T Ford had the dual starting system. It had the electric mechanical starter with a starter button, and it also had the crank out in front if the batteries were low, that the mechanical starter wouldn't, the electric starter wouldn't turn it over. So the boys up at Hub City tied a fish line on Earl's choker wire, and Earl would get his Model T started and then just ready to put it into reverse and back out, and then the boys would pull on the string and that would choke it to death. And he would start it again, just get ready to go, and the boys would choke it again. And he would get angrier and angrier and angrier. And finally he got out and he was going to jerk up the hood and he was going to see what in the world was the matter with that car. And he had to walk across the front and ran into the fish line and found what the joke was, and that he was the one the joke was being played on. And he was quite angry with everybody up and down the road.
A lot of people were mean to Earl
Seigerman. They were. Yes, they laughed at him. When I first grew up, he was characterized as a man that believed that men descended from monkeys. And this was the characterization that was prevalent during the Scopes trial, that if you believed in evolution, you just had to believe that men descended from monkeys, which was far from the process. And Earl was characterized by that. I think he was hurt when he had to quit teaching school, because ideally this was his field in life. This is what he could do best, because he was able to project. In my own experience in teaching, I remember what a time that I had with grammar. I had a real time with grammar. Next year I was going to have to teach this stuff. I was in County Teachers College. And yet Earl came over with me and sat down one night, and we went through the whole process of grammar. And you saw it in such a logical light that it just really wasn't a problem after that. And I'm sure that he taught many other things that same way. But of course, the fields that he liked best were botany and geology and that sort of thing.
I'm always interested in his awareness of prehistory. I think that was one of the things that set him apart from people, and that there are stories about prehistoric that I would like to hear. I was always intrigued that the skeleton in Madison was from the Dutch farm. And Earl had found trilobites.
Oh, yes. The trilobites became our old friends, because Earl knew which shale beds to go into and find trilobites. And you don't find trilobites in this area until you get into the high shale beds that are near the tops of the hills. Because in the sandstones in which we live were so early that there was very little life. With the tops of the hills, thousands and millions of years had elapsed and life had evolved until at the tops of the hills you do find fossils. So, I remember